Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Last week, two California couples reported that they gave birth to each other's babies after a mix-up at a fertility clinic and spent months raising children that were not theirs before swapping the infants months later. So a lot of you had questions about this. How common is it for this to happen? How are these fertility clinics monitored so that this doesn't happen? Joining me now is Dr. Andrew Levi, who is with Park Avenue Fertility and Reproductive Medicine. They have multiple offices in Fairfield County, and I wanted to go to a local clinic to, well, first of all, they're the ones who we work with here in Connecticut, but also to give you local perspective. So, Dr. Levi, thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I guess let's address the elephant in the room first and foremost. How common is it for something like the California situation to happen?
Yeah, when things like this transpire, it's clearly devastating to the couples involved. These are extremely, extremely rare, but they can happen. They shouldn't happen. And what they do is they make clinics like ourselves reevaluate what we're doing, because this is all about patient safety. We need to have the protocols in place that make patients feel safe, and these protocols need to be just as important as the protocols that help people get pregnant.
And I know that we have actually some of our listeners who work with your offices, and it was one of the reasons I wanted to reach out to you guys. How do you monitor? Actually, you know what? Let's back up. What is the process? So you have a couple who comes in, they say, we can't get pregnant, we'd like to do something like IVF. So how does that work?
Well, in terms of the process itself, I meet a couple, we take a good history, we figure out why they're not getting pregnant, and then we'll implement a given treatment based on their age, how long they've been trying to get pregnant for, and the reason for why they're not conceiving. And that could be a couple of different things. It could be as simple as inseminating a woman with her husband or partner's sperm. It could be a single woman, who's using donor sperm. But ultimately, we do have a lot of people who do in vitro fertilization, which is taking the egg, fertilizing it with sperm, and creating an embryo. So the process starts with me getting to know this couple, or this woman for that matter, and understanding what's best for them, and then implementing the appropriate treatment.
But just to be clear with everybody, Dr. Levi, you take the embryo from that woman who wants to get pregnant. So it is her egg that
Correct.
You are fertilizing. Okay.
Yeah. So there are cases where we use a donor egg or donor sperm for that matter. But yeah, so if it's a couple or a woman and she's going to use her egg, that's correct. It is her egg.
Okay. So how would something, and again, I'm not inferencing that you guys have gone through this at all, but how would that get mixed up? I know you said it's rare, but how, you know, just a simple writing your name on the test tube, I would
yeah.
think would have kept it clear. I don't, maybe
yeah,
I sound crazy.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I am always excited when patients ask me the question that you're asking me. And they kind of, when they ask me, well, how do we know? They kind of say it sheepishly because there's a lot of trust between myself and my patients, but I like when they ask these questions because they need to hear how we keep them safe. And the bottom line is redundancy, 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 multiple IDs. Our patients get annoyed sometimes when it's the seventh time that we've asked them how to spell their name, what their name is, their partner's name, their date of birth, their social security number. So the way this is done, multiple people involved, multiple witnesses, multiple IDs, and because we're a smaller office, we have the luxury of we have a lot of order here. We work on one patient at a time. We're never in a situation where there's multiple specimens being worked at a given time. And in larger clinics, that's inevitable, but they will have protocols also in place to ensure patient safety. So you're never going to be in a situation where I'm going to say to a patient, and I'm going to be the single ID. There's always multiple IDs. And before I put an embryo inside a patient, she will always hear me say, your embryo has been ID'd by multiple people, including myself. You have been ID'd by multiple people, including myself, which means we're good to go. So the redundancy, it's no different than other parts of medicine. It's no different than the operating room where they ensure that the right hip is replaced and not the left hip. And that's because this redundancy. So issues occur when there's a lack of redundancy and a lack of order, and that is definitely a priority in our office, and I would say all fertility offices.
And we're talking this morning to Dr. Levi. Dr. Levi is a local a doctor here. He is with Park Avenue Fertility and Reproductive Medicine. How long have you been in practice, Dr. Levi?
You know, it's about 20 years now. So, you know, you're making me feel older when I say that. But it's, I'm from New Jersey originally and came to Connecticut about 20 years ago. So we're about 20 years now.
Okay, well, Dr. Levi, you sound about 40. So as far as I'm concerned, everyone thinks you started at 20. So not old at all. You're perfectly fine. The reason I ask that, though, Dr. Levi, is because, and granted, I understand from a legal perspective, the attorney representing this couple in California has to win their case, of course, for good reason. But he made a comment on national television that while you'll hear doctors say this is very rare, you shouldn't worry about it, that in fact it happens more than we would anticipate, but couples are so damaged by what happened that they won't speak up about it. I mean, is there any truth to that? Maybe not in your practice, but in general, I mean, do we see this more than we probably should? Like, are there enough protocols in place happening at these big fertility clinics?
There are, and this is in fact rare, but that attorney, whatever he or she said, they're right, that we should be concerned. We have to be concerned. If this is not a priority to any medical facility, whether it's a hospital, whether it's a blood bank, who is everyone has protocols. You have to make sure the right blood goes to the right person. We have to have those protocols in place. It is rare, but it needs to be zero. When my patients ask me these questions, I say with 100% certainty, and I explain the protocols, and they need that reassurance so they can move on and focus on what they really need to focus on, which is getting pregnant. It's our job to make them feel safe. So this is not a common occurrence at all. It's kind of like, remember that Octomom that occurred when...
Yes.
It's the same kind of thing. This does not happen. No one transfers 8 embryos inside of a patient. But when it happens, it brings to light the importance that we're all accountable and we all have to explain our protocols and how we do it. So, again, first and foremost, our patients, they all need to feel safe. Should the patients be worried? No. Should they be concerned? They should ask the appropriate questions. They should be their own advocates. While there's certainly an element of trust, they should not be afraid to ask questions of their physicians to say, how do I know? And it's our job to prove it to them. They have to feel safe.
Dr. Levi, where are your offices located if anybody does want to consult with you for their own personal reasons?
Yeah, so we have satellite offices in Fairfield and Norwalk. Our main office is in Trumbull, so we straddle the Trumbull-Fairfield border. So we're really local, which is nice. We're right up the Merritt Parkway. So we cater to all of Connecticut, Fairfield, New Haven counties, all counties for that matter. But we're always taking new patients. We're always eager to help. And it's a time right now where stories like this happen and people are hesitant sometimes to seek care because they say, oh my gosh, now these things are happening. But again, these are very, very uncommon, but patients need to be able to ask these questions so they feel comfortable.
Dr. Andrew Levi, who is with Park Avenue Fertility and Reproductive Medicine, we thank you so much for giving us your perspective and also just being able to take such a big picture and really localize it for us. We really appreciate it.
Well, so I'm glad, and hopefully it gives the patients reassurance so when they seek care, they can feel comfortable doing it.
I agree. And actually, Dr. Levi, before I let you go, would you suggest if someone goes to a clinic, again, I know you do, consistently, and you have a lot of people who are overlooking and overseeing these samples, but if somebody were to go to one of those bigger clinics, let's just say, like maybe we have a listener who has family in New York or in another state, and they don't have access to a smaller clinic, would you suggest that they also almost like pester the doctor saying, hey, well, prove to me that you've had 5 other people look at this. And should people also be over advocating for themselves to avoid this?
I think big clinic, small clinic, it makes no difference. I think that, yes, certainly there may be more patients at a given time in a larger clinic, but the protocol should be exactly the same. So my message is that the questions that a patient asks to a single practitioner like myself should be the same questions for a larger clinic. There's patients who would go to larger clinics should not be worried. They really shouldn't be worried at all. Zero. They should be just as confident coming to my office to a larger office, but which doesn't change the fact that if it's on their mind, they should be asking their physicians. All clinics should have the same standard, regardless of how large the clinic is or how many physicians they have.
And they should be having, like you said, you know, multiple people overseeing one family.
Yeah,
like
I would that. Tell you that yeah. if they're having a procedure and they're concerned about it, and they're concerned about the lack of IDing, they should say, hey, you didn't ask this, you didn't ask that. There's going to be situations at larger clinics. I'm lucky. I know all my patients. There's never a patient that I'm going to do a procedure on who doesn't know me and I don't know them. Mm-hmm. But in a larger clinic, there's going to be a situation where a patient's going to have an embryo transfer and they're likely going to be meeting a physician for the first time. They've never even met them before, and they may be doing their embryo transfer. They have to feel comfortable about all the IDing. So the onus is on that physician who's never met that patient, say, hi, I'm Dr. Smith, or whatever his or her name might be, and reassure them and say, these are all the appropriate IDs that we did. I really do believe clinics are great that way. Just, you know, no matter whether they're big or small. Mm-hmm. But if a patient doesn't kind of sense that, they should really ask the questions and say, you didn't ask this, you didn't ask that, how do I know? Please reassure me.
Dr. Levi, I think all great things and really great tips this morning. And again, thank you so much for your perspective. We appreciate it.
No, thank you for your time. I appreciate it too.
Your city, your mayor. Melissa in the Morning with Mayor Joe Ganim, WICC 600.
Good morning, Mayor Ganim. Boy, you've been busy.
Who is this?
What do you mean, who is this? It's Melissa.
Oh, Melissa. I'm juggling four lines. I was just kidding. It's a pleasure to be on with you, WICC, and all the great listeners. How are you?
I was nervous for a second there. Well,
no,
I thought maybe
no,
you were
no,
jet-lagged
no.
a little bit. My understanding is you were out of the country.
I am a little jet-lagged, actually.
What? You didn't tell me you were traveling. Thanks a lot, Mayor Ganim.
You know what? First of all, I did talk to a reporter before going. There was a local connection, and there was some real back and forth about how much time and that I wanted to spend away. And the travel restrictions with COVID are very difficult. We don't have the time to go into them today, but they make it almost prohibitive. But I thought it was not only worthwhile, but it was kind of historic. After Paris 5 years ago, which was the accord on climate, this was the follow-up where elected officials from around the world, you saw heads of state, and leaders coming together to develop a consensus around a goal. And if we don't do this, if we don't recognize global warming and the impact on the climate, here in Bridgeport, for instance, if sea levels rise the way they're predicted to do, if we don't take corrective action, there's a good portion of our city that will literally be underwater. You know, we have problems now with resiliency and protection and putting berms up down in the south end. So, Seaside Village has been struck, as in other parts of the city, with water damage in high tides and storms. So this is something that impacts us as Connecticut's largest city, as a region, but part of the global world. And I think there was a real coming together. Some disagreements at the end over how they were going to word the elimination of carbon and reduction in some countries pushing back. But overall, it was a real coming together and an eye-opener, I think, and I was glad to be able to participate in it, despite difficulties in traveling and being out of town for a few days.
I'm curious, Mayor Ganim, how did you get the invitation to go to that? And that's not to be – I don't want that to sound offensively, but like
– No.
You know,
we don't – it's not something that makes it into a normal kind of casual conversation around here. But since the 90s, I've been part of an organization known as the United States Conference of Mayors. I was elected by my colleagues to the advisory board, which is the along with the trustees. But I've also been part of the organization's outreach internationally. And so I've worked with mayors across the country on a variety of topics and around the world. And we have a lot of commonalities. You can have differences because of geography, because of culture. But I was credentialed through the U.S. Conference of Mayors. It was a U.N. event, so we were, in effect, observers technically, but we were in the room, and we're a part of it, and we're able to participate. And I was, along with other mayors, I was there with the Secretary of Transportation as well, other dignitaries, trying to make an impact and let people know that not only do we want to see this happen, we want to be part of implementing some of what comes out of it, and that's what we'll do in Bridgeport. I want to reach our goals, which we haven't announced or set yet, here to reduce carbon emissions in the city of Bridgeport. I want to be a leader. A couple of years ago, I went and participated in Europe on a few days about our thermal loop, which is innovative, and we're the only city in the country, at least the United States, that is heading in that direction. So we've got a lot of things to do. We've decommissioned the last coal-burning plant, which should have been done decades ago, the last coal-burning plant in Connecticut, Bridgeport's waterfront, and we're opening that site up for redevelopment. So it's important. It's important enough for us to play our role nationally and internationally, and I've done that, again, as a member of the U.S. Conference of Mayors and internationally as well, but also how it impacts us locally. So it was tiring. Jet lag was the least of the lumps I took on this trip. I got tested more times in several days than I have in 6 months, but it was part of the protocol, and I appreciated the precautions and measures that they took.
Yeah, I can imagine. I'm just curious, Mayor Ganim. I just want to make sure I'm asking the questions of my listeners. There was an article that has been sent to me probably three or four times by Chris Powell in the Connecticut Post saying, quote, why did the mayor not announce his trip? Probably because the trip was less a matter of reaching climate policy goals than a matter of self-importance, and announcing it would have prompted wonder and ridicule. What do you say to that?
Oh, I didn't read that article, so I don't know. I think everybody's entitled to their opinion, as off base as it might be. It's really hard to get praise from some sectors of the media, but that's okay. I think everybody can go their own way. I think the important thing is that in addition to fixing potholes, as we talked about there, trying to deal with the 911 calls and organize the city for continued job growth and all that, I think we also play a major role in looking forward to the next generation and what they do. And when I have the opportunity as a representative, not just of Bridgeport, but of mayors across the country, as part of mayors from around the world, who represent the largest population that are impacted or that can make a difference in what will happen for the next generation. I take it as kind of a responsibility, if I can do it, and as an honor to go. So everybody's entitled to their opinion. I've been at this too long to start getting into mincing words over what people might think or might say. Everybody has a right to say and take their perspective on it, and then people who are listening can figure out what they want to make of it.
Absolutely. And then I had one more question, and then I know we have to, I want to talk about some other big things happening, but one of your city council women, Maria Pereira, actually said on one of our other shows, she suggested that you were using taxpayer dollars to go on this trip. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't know what she said. There's protocol for travel in every budget. We have ours. So, I mean, it's so easy for people to do is just say things that are unfounded and flippant. And I'm sorry that, some of that has to take up our time this morning. But so it's a normal protocol. It's what needs to be done, whether it's driving a car or anything. There's there's things that are part of the job that, just come with the job. And this is one of them. Sometimes they're easy to do. Sometimes they're enjoyable. Sometimes they're difficult. I think this was a combination of both, more the latter than the former.
Okay, but it was taxpayer dollars that paid for it, but that's in your contract.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just confirming it, just making sure.
Yeah, everything the city does is pretty much, city budget. There's no, this was not a personal trip. My personal trips are done separately, and, something interesting to people what the mayor does and what he doesn't do, and I get that. And the personal stuff I don't usually go on the radio and talk about, but this was a city trip. It was important for us. It was important. I says not only an obligation and honor to be there, but also to learn and to participate. And there's always people that, want to pick up on the negative. But Bridgeport has pushed that type of attitude aside, I think, and has continued to make progress. And if we can continue on, I think we're going to see over the next period of time some unprecedented progress because of the support that we've seen from other levels of government with taxpayer dollars, like the American Rescue Plan and funds, which we're announcing later today, like the infrastructure plan that mayors, myself included, played a critical role in it. in order to see that pass. We haven't seen that in a lifetime or a generation, and that's going to help support the expansion or the solidification of the utilization of our airport, some of our bridges. I heard talks about the Pleasure Beach Bridge this morning, about some of the projects that we want to see downtown. I'd like to see that expanded to things like some of the arts and entertainment and theaters that we have in the city. And so it's an exciting time for the city. And again, you know, I'm going to just touch on it because you did. There's always going to be, and sometimes we give too much ear, too much voice to people that want to hold back progress in the city that impacts positively the lives of 150,000 people in this city. But my job is to stay focused, set the course, to push in the right direction, to make sure that we get there. And I think the people of the city of Bridgeport, are going to see over the next few, not just months, but the next few years, some real tangible differences and changes, some visible like the mural project and Seaview Avenue, which was kicked off today, and other stuff around the city that that they want to see in their neighborhoods and as part of, as I like to refer to us, as Connecticut's largest city that continues to grow and prosper and head in a positive direction.
From supply shortages to inflation, it's really a top of mind for everyone. And I thought it's about time we have an economic expert come on the show. Joining me this morning, I'm very happy to have on Leah Hartman. Leah is a distinguished lecturer and coordinator of finance at the University of New Haven. Good morning, Leah. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So, Leah, give us some perspective, because I think this has rocked everyone, especially coming off of a pandemic where many were already financially struggling. When's the last time we saw something so severe with supply shortages and inflation rates like we're seeing now?
Well, we haven't seen inflation rates like this for more than 30 years. But back in the late 70s, early 80s, we actually had inflation ranging from 9 to 13%. So it's been around, but it's just been a really long time.
I mean, and like when you say the 70s, you're talking about there's a, at least a generation and a half of people who have never experienced inflation. I'm thinking of the 80s, 90s kids, like they've never even experienced this before.
Absolutely. With most of those inflation reports falling either below 2% or no more than like 3.5%. So 6.2% was a shocking report for so many people.
And, you know, Leah, we're starting to see especially so many are focused on the holidays for understandable reasons. You know, we're looking at now Christmas trees might be in jeopardy of shortages. And we're talking about food for Thanksgiving, or we're seeing inflation rates that are going to make it more expensive to get your meals together, in toys getting in on time and things like that. But let's look at stuff that I would say is more important, not to say that holidays are not. But we can live without a Christmas tree if we don't have one, is what I'm getting at. What are some of the more severe things we're seeing impacted by shortage supplies and inflation?
I think in particular, we're seeing food prices and gasoline, which hits everyone. But those that are on the lower income side of things, certainly the food budget, the gasoline budget, going back to work, right, is a good thing. But it now costs a lot more to put gasoline in the tank. So it's a disproportionate share of that income to lower income. So I think that will continue. There's access to food. A month ago, it was really hard to find a turkey. Now you can, but you're paying for it.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. And again, Leah Hartman is here. If you're just tuning in, she is a distinguished lecturer and coordinator of finance at the University of New Haven. And I wanted to get Leah's perspective from an economic standpoint, what we're really dealing with the supply shortage and inflation. So, Leah, here's the big question that everybody wants to know, which I know you don't have a crystal ball, so no worries. But from your professional standpoint, when does this end? When do we go back to quote unquote normal?
Well, I think there's two parts to that, right? One is getting product on the shelves, and we're starting to see glimmers of hope with that. Walmart reported their earnings yesterday for the third quarter and said that they would have full holiday shelves for the holiday shopping season. It's costing them more as well. Producer prices are up over 8.5% this past month. So everything will be more expensive, but access to goods is slightly improving. As far as settling down, that rate of inflation. Again, my crystal ball, I'm rubbing really hard on it. I think we'll see high reports for the rest of this calendar year, and would expect easing to be reported maybe more toward the March quarter reports.
Okay. So that includes gas prices staying this high.
Right. Gas prices staying high. There was a report coming out that there's disruption on natural gas pipeline in Russia. And again, while that's a long way away, it is, a spook to the natural gas supply. So I think overall energy prices will remain high. It will be curious to see how high they are and depending on how terrible the winter weather might be and the higher demand for energy.
And I know, Leah, you just mentioned a couple of things having to do with why we're in the state we're in right now. But this may seem very elementary, but just to walk people through, why are we where we're at this point? Why are inflation rates as high as they are? Gosh, higher than they've been even in the last 50 years. It's pretty crazy.
Well, in part, it's because it's good news, in part, because the economy is in an expansionary mode. We're recovering from the shutdown from COVID. And if you look at GDP growth rates, J.P. Morgan just lifted their forecast for the fourth quarter of this year from 4 to 5%. That's a notable jump in forecast. Earnings reports are coming out to be quite strong. So as you have expansion, then you have inflation coming right behind it. And there are, historical patterns for over 90 years of data that show that very thing. We are at a near 50-year low on the unemployment rate, which is pretty incredible. But again, if people have money in their pockets, they're spending it. We've had pent-up demand. We have nearly full employment here where the targets are supposed to be. There's money out there to be spent. And that demand is pushing up prices.
So you think regardless that many were struggling last year, maybe you're trying to get back on their feet, even with the high prices, you think people are going to spend the money?
I think there's so much pent-up demand, and I think we want a little holiday cheer, whether it's holiday cheer, we want, different food on the table, right? We upgrade from where we were, but with people back to work, I think they will be spending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll just maybe be tapping into savings or maybe having to budget next year a little bit, kind of pull back a little bit. Well, Leah Hartman, we so appreciate getting your perspective. Again, Leah is a distinguished lecturer and coordinator of finance at the University of New Haven, and she is one of our economic experts here on the show. We thank you so much for your time, Leah. I hope to talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Melissa. It's been my pleasure.
Absolutely. You're welcome back anytime, Leah. Thank you so much.
Connecting commerce to your community. Bridgeport Regional Business Council President and CEO Dan Onofrio is on the Listen in the Morning on WICC 600.
Good morning, Dan. Thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing this morning, Melissa?
I'm doing well, thank you. I wanted to talk about actually one of our top stories this week. Sikorsky Airport potentially being taken over by the Connecticut Airport Authority. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's great news. The airport, as we all know, has been running in the red for quite some time, and the city's been trying to figure out how to position it. And as you know, when Governor Lovat came in, he really reinforced the need for a regional airport here in south central Connecticut, which kind of became a little bit of a battle, I guess, for lack of a better word, between the New Haven Tweeds Airport and Sikorsky Memorial, who can get leverage there. So having the Connecticut Airport Authority just even interested in terms of operations is a huge lift for the city. Obviously, I don't think the city, this is my personal opinion, should necessarily be in the business of operating the airport, but having an agency like the CAA, who's had tremendous success at Bradley Airport, International Airport, having them operate in some capacity, Sikorsky is a huge thing. I think it accomplishes many things, particularly with how the financials are run, but just with day-to-day operations, and then ultimately the compliance issues and keeping the airport in a situation where the FAA recognizes it and allows for future funding.
You know, and the thing that stands out to me, Dan, is immediately my question is going to be, when do we bring back commercial airlines? Like, when do we bring back flights where people can just go for leisure? When, you know, does that make this more possible in the near future?
Yeah, it's definitely a huge step forward because if you recall, I think we talked about it a while back, but the state of Connecticut has $7 million set aside for Sikorsky Airport just to upgrade it. Do some necessary upgrades really to keep it compliant as related to the runways. So just, you know, maintaining that status of safety and compliance, you know, governed by the FAA and other airport requirements, you know, having that in our back pocket now and being able to execute on that is that first next step. And I think, you know, we'll see commercial interest as we have in the past from airlines that may be interested in having some flights come and go, commercial flights come and go out of there now that they see that there's a process, there's a plan, there's progress with some support from an agency like CAA. So I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. I think it gets us a little bit closer, but I think there's still a lot more work that needs to be done.
And I'm curious, Dan Onofrio of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council, who's here this morning. My understanding is, you know, as you mentioned, Sikorsky's been in the deficit, and my understanding is about $500,000 a year is basically the bill is footed by Bridgeport's city budget. It's fit into there. So now if the Connecticut Airport Authority were to take this over and that now doesn't really fall on Bridgeport, any idea what the city would do with that extra money?
Well, I love to believe that, you know, they can repurpose it in some kind of infrastructure related to the, you know, transportation in and around the city, whether it's through you know, their support for fiber, which is a big issue, but also just in general with the roads and you know, typical maintenance like that. Obviously, there's always a need for more dollars we put into our infrastructure in and around the city. So, you know, I don't know exactly. I'm not privy to those conversations, but I would suspect that they would repurpose those dollars in a similar line item related to transportation and infrastructure.
And this also might be out of your realm, Dan, but I figured I'd ask it while we're on the topic. Because the city was basically, well, it was owning Sikorsky Airport, what does that mean for residents who, you know, maybe they want to speak up about, for example, like a runway extension or something like that, or expansion projects at Sikorsky? Typically, that would be something I would think that they'd have to take up with the city of Bridgeport. But now, if Bridgeport weren't to be in charge of it, do you know if it's handled differently, like if those matters would be handled differently because it's now a separate entity overlooking the airport?
Yeah, I think they would still have to go through some kind of public process, you know, as it relates to any kind of expansion there. Yeah, obviously, there, you know, there's ordinances, you know, in and around the neighborhood of Sikorsky Memorial Airport. So depending on the project and what it is, of course, I think the public would have input into, you know, any major type of expansions or things of that nature. I think initially, though, I don't think that the play there is to expand the runway. I think it was more of a widening of the runway. I think they've eliminated, you know, in including with new technology with the airlines, and you know, they don't need the long runways any longer to take off and to land. So, you know, I don't think we have to worry too much about expansion, especially at Sikorsky Memorial Airport, where, you know, there's the wetlands there and stuff like that. But I think any kind of major development certainly will go through a public process, as it typically does. I think that's pretty normal due course. And I'm just excited from a business perspective because, you know, beyond the commercial services that potentially we could see there, it also has a huge economic impact just from a business perspective, right? You know, it allows for corporations and people looking at the greater Bridgeport region to relocate their businesses or existing businesses to have travel coming in and out of Sikorsky Memorial is a huge benefit as opposed to either going down to Westchester or some other area airports.
And I'm just curious, Dan, this is more of a personal question. What are you hoping, like what destinations, if they were to bring commercial airlines back, what destinations would you like to see flying out of Stratford?
I chuckle because people who know me well, you know, my first comment is always Italy, right? Because that's where I go often with my family stuff. But of course, that's probably not going to happen. But, you know, I think any, you know, I always look at it through the business lens, of course. you know, seeing travel to the major hubs, you know, like the Atlantas and stuff like that, I think is huge. Obviously, Bradley kind of covers a lot of that. But if we're going to be targeting, you know, the Florida markets or the Carolinas, I think those are big wins for us, especially with our manufacturing presence and the manufacturing presence down in the Carolinas. I think that would be very worthwhile look at destinations. And then, of course, you know, the major hubs, like I mentioned before, anything that we can connect to those, I think will be a benefit. This way, you know, people can get to other destinations that they prefer to get to.
Well, the possibilities certainly are endless, and we're excited about the news, and we'll see if the Connecticut Airport Authority does end up taking over Sikorsky. Dan Onofrio, thank you so much for your input on this morning. We appreciate it.
You got it, Melissa. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. All right. One of my favorite times of the week because I get to indulge in my sports. Justin Develis of News 12 Sports is here. You can catch Justin on News 12 every weekday evening starting at 4 o'clock all the way through the 10 o'clock broadcast. Justin, welcome back in studio. How are you?
What's up? I'm great. How are you?
I mean, I'm great. You brought me Dunkin', which is so nice of you. I'm so happy.
Oh, man. Yeah, anything for you.
Well, I appreciate you. I appreciate you, friend. Oh, my gosh. I was channeling you so hard, Justin, because the news out of UConn. So the only time I've gone to a UConn football game, it was a blast in the parking lot. But then literally once we got to the game, it was so disappointing watching them. So when I heard that they got a new head coach, I was floored because I thought, wait, maybe we have a shot at being something other than nothing,
yeah.
Essentially.
Well, I mean, you said that about the tailgate.
I have no problem.
You said it.
Yeah, no, it was fun. It was
yeah,
great.
The tailgates
awesome.
Are great.
Yeah.
The tailgates are great. But yeah, that was big news, and I think it happened to drop the day after I think we taped last week's
yeah,
segment.
Exactly.
So it's been like 6 days, but Jim Mora, yeah, former NFL head coach and former UCLA coach. We were just talking about it. And I mean, he's gotten a lot of brownie points because over the weekend, like, he went to the women's basketball game, you know, at the XL Center.
Oh, that's awesome.
Spoke, you know, in the middle
of
the court.
For their opening?
Yeah. He went to the football game against Clemson, and, you know, after the game, he was, you know, shaking hands with all the players. So, you know, making a good first impression. I mean, it's always
awesome.
Good when it starts, you know.
Yeah.
But he's making a good first impression, and people are excited
that
he's here.
So he was with a few different NFL teams, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He was an assistant with a couple teams, and then he was the head coach of Seattle, actually,
right.
For the year before Pete Carroll. Like, he's
That's
the Seahawks
crazy.
Coach right now. But,
right.
Yeah, Mora was the head coach. He was with the Falcons. He took the Falcons to the NFC Championship game, I believe it was
That's
like 2004
mm-hmm.
with Michael Vick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was good, too, because he had his like, initial press conference when they announced it, and you got to ask him a couple questions. You know, I got to ask him a couple questions, talk
yeah.
about, you know, how are you going to attract in-state, like, recruits, you
right.
know what I'm saying?
Right.
And basically he said, if there is a good player in the state of Connecticut, like, he needs to become Husky.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they need
sure.
that burning desire. They need to build an attractive program to make sure that, you know, football players in the state
mm-hmm.
actually have a burning desire to then go to stores and play.
Right.
Which haven't had that in the last couple of years. But, you know, maybe something's different now.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm curious, why did he decide UConn? And again, I love UConn. I talk about it all the time. I lived in South Africa for 7 months when I was in college. And the only thing that resonated for my friends who were African, when I told them, well, I'm actually from Connecticut, not New York, but, you know, Connecticut's kind of like this small state, whatever, was they said, oh, you have the Huskies. Like, everyone knows our basketball program.
Yes.
They know us. But our football program, and I'm not saying, this is not, you know, an opinion. This is a fact. That's not what we're on the map for, is all I'm going to say.
Right.
Why would he come to UConn? Like, it's to me, it seems like you have such an exciting career. Why go to UConn? Like, does he just want to clean it up? Is this more of like a, hey, or what drove him to come here? Do you know?
Well, I think from stuff I've read and the stuff I've heard, I think it's just the challenge
yeah.
of kind of resurrecting, like, UConn. Because, like you said, like, you know, obviously he's getting paid. I mean, he gets paid
sure.
to coach.
Sure.
But you're right. I mean, my guess is he didn't need to come to UConn. He could have, you know,
probably
stayed
gone anywhere.
He could have gone different places, maybe. I never know what kind of, you know, offers he had. He could have gone to different places. He also could have been, you know, just working in media. He had been
right.
a broadcaster. He could
sure.
have stayed there.
Right. Sure, sure.
And like, the East Coast thing. Like, he grew up on the West Coast. He played on the West Coast, coached, you know,
right.
on the West Coast, and then again in Atlanta. But, like, he's also never been.
Right, he's
like,
not a New
England.
Like, not New England.
No, he's not. So that's interesting. But I think it's the whole, like, the challenge of, you know, I think he said the other day, like, this is why we do what it is that we do. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's a challenge. And I guess he wants to be the guy.
I mean, so. I'm excited that he's the guy. Yeah. I'm very excited about it. I know that we're running out of time. Did you have other stuff you wanted to chat on?
Yeah, I mean, I had a little bit. So I was still thawing out from last night. Wilton High, the field hockey team, they beat yet another top-seeded team in the state tournament. So Wilton's going to the state final.
Wow.
In field hockey, and they're going to play New Canaan up in Weathersfield Saturday. Scoreless tie. Through regulation, 0-0 through both overtimes. It went to penalty strokes, went to strokes. And Wilton High ended up winning, hitting the game-winning goal.
Oh,
they walked it off, and it was just a crazy scene there. Cold, but congratulations to the Warriors. First state final since 2015.
Wow.
And again, you can tell me whenever I have to stop.
No, you're good. You're good. You've got 30 seconds left. Go
oh,
for
wow.
It.
Okay. So the Staples High boys soccer team plays in the Class AA state semifinal tonight in Waterbury. Going to try to hit that. And then the other thing, like we talked about, Staples High football. Remember they dedicated the field Friday?
Yes, yes.
They go into halftime losing. 10-6.
Uh-huh.
And they do the ceremony at halftime, you know, for the legendary
right.
coach Paul Lane. Wreckers come out of the break. They score 20 unanswered points to win and to beat Ridgefield.
Well, someone's
so
spirit
like said,
was in
yeah.
that halftime speech,
yeah.
right?
I it mean, was like geez. You said. Yeah. And then just a recap, we went 3-1 in our picks. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, did we go 3-1?
Yeah, we went 3-1.
Wow.
The Browns over the Patriots, I took. That was the only loss. Bad pick.
I could have told you.
Yeah. I'm not making excuses. It was announced the next day that the Browns running back was going to be out of the game. I don't think he would have been worth, you know, 30 points
right,
like they lost
right.
by. But,
right.
And then picks for this week. I'm going to go. I picked against the Patriots last week. So what am I going to do?
You owe them.
No, I'm going to do the same thing again. I'm going to pick against them. Falcons +7. It's the Thursday night game.
Okay.
Falcons
yes, I know. Yeah.
I've seen it at like 6.5. Last night it was at 7, so I took it. There's no reason the Jets should be competitive in this Dolphins game.
I am a Dolphins fan, so I'm hoping that the Dolphins win.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And Mark Sagowski actually told me that you are a Dolphins
yes,
fan. Relayed that information to me.
Hi, Mark.
So, and again, I'm sorry. I'm going to go with the Jets +3. You know what? No, let's change it. Let's
How
change
dare
it.
You?
Let's change it.
How
let's do Dolphins.
How dare you?
Jets
Mark,
haven't announced their starter.
Mark, if you're listening right now, you can give Justin some, you know.
I'm switching.
Some shade.
Okay,
you can give him
I'm
shade.
Switching. I'm
I
switching.
I can't believe you're.
I'm on the record switching. Dolphins -3. Jets haven't announced their starter yet.
Okay.
It's gonna come back to backfire on me, but it doesn't matter. And then last pick, Bucks Giants Monday night. I'm going to go with the Bucks -11. Bucks
okay.
-11 against the Giants. It hurts me. I hate to do it, but Tom Brady coming off an embarrassing loss to Washington. I'm going to take the Bucks and the points.
I think that's fair. All right. Justin yeah. DeVellis, News 12 Sports. Of course, you can catch him on News 12 every weeknight from 4 until the 10 o'clock broadcast there on News 12. Thank you, Justin. Always appreciate it.
Thanks so much.